Just a few days before he was to return home, his Jeep ran over a mine. I was sick. Tommy Young was a big, smart, ungainly, sensitive guy who I thought would grow up to have a good life. Seeing his name on the list, along with others I was sure had more to give and get in life, triggered the first pangs of guilt I felt about being a student and touching the desk in Vietnam from a distance. I briefly flirted with the idea of dropping out of school and enlisting in the military. After all, I was a Democrat in philosophy as well as party. I didn't feel entitled to escape even a war I had come to oppose. I talked to Lee Williams about it. He said I'd be crazy to quit school, that I wouldn't prove anything by being one more soldier, perhaps one more casualty. Rationally, I could understand that, and I went on about my business, but I never felt quite right about it. So began my personal bout with guilt, one that was fought by many thousands of us who loved our country but hated the war. It was an unwinnable battle, one we could only hope to fight to a draw, sort of like Vietnam itself. In the spring of 1967, Daddy's cancer had worsened, and he went to the Duke Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina, for several weeks of treatment. Every weekend, I would drive the 266 miles from Georgetown to see him, leaving Friday afternoon, returning late Sunday night. I couldn't do it and make my communism course, so I bagged it. It was one of the most exhausting but important times of my young life. I would get into Durham late Friday night, then go get Daddy and spend Saturday with him. We'd spend Sunday morning and early afternoon together, then I'd head back to school and work. On those weekends, Daddy talked to me in a way he never had before. Mostly it was small talk, about my life and his, mother and Roger, family and friends. Some of it was deeper, as he reflected on the life he knew he would be leaving soon enough. But even with the small stuff, he spoke with an openness, a depth, a lack of defensiveness I had never heard before. On those long, languid weekends, we came to terms with each other, and he accepted the fact that I loved and forgave him. If he could only have faced life with the same courage and sense of honor with which he faced death, he would have been quite a guy. My senior year was a strange combination of interesting college life and cataclysmic personal and political events. As I look back on it, it seems weird that anyone could be absorbed in so many big and little things at the same time. But people inevitably search for the pleasures and deal with the pain of normal life under difficult, even bizarre circumstances. In the fall, Daddy's cancer had spread, and it was clear that further treatment wouldn't help. He was in the hospital for a while, but he wanted to come home to die. He told Mother he didn't want me to miss too much school, so they didn't call me right away. One day he said, "It's time." Mother sent for me, and I flew home. I knew it was coming, and I just hoped he would still know me when I got there, so that I could tell him I loved him. By the time I arrived, Daddy had gone to bed for good, getting up only to go to the bathroom and then only with help. After a week, he was seldom more than half conscious, though he had surges of mental activity almost to the end. Twice he woke to tell Mother and me he was still there. After his final attempt to communicate, he lasted 1.5 horrible days. It was awful hearing the hard, sharp thrust of his breathing and seeing his body bloat into disfigurement that did not look like anything I'd ever seen. Somewhere near the end, Mother came in and saw him, burst into tears, and told him she loved him. After all he had put her through, I hope she meant it, more for her sake than for his. A month after Daddy's funeral, I came home again for the Rhodes Scholarship interview. Every year, 32 American Rhodes Scholars were chosen for 2 years of study at Oxford, paid for by the trust established in 1903 by Cecil Rhodes' will. Rhodes, who made a fortune in South Africa's diamond mines, provided for scholarships for young men from all the present and former British colonies who had demonstrated outstanding intellectual, athletic, and leadership qualities. He wanted to send people to Oxford who were interested in and accomplished in more than academics, because he thought they would be more likely to esteem the performance of public duties over purely private pursuits. Over the years, selection committees had come to discount a lack of athletic prowess if a candidate had excelled in some other non-academic field. In a few more years, the trust would be amended to allow women to compete. A student could apply either in the state where he lived or the one where he went to college. Every December, each state nominated two candidates who then went to one of 8 regional competitions, in which scholars were chosen for the coming academic year. The selection process required the candidate to provide between 5 and 8 letters of recommendation, write an essay on why he wanted to go to Oxford, and submit to interviews at the state and regional levels by panels composed of former Rhodes Scholars, with a chairman who wasn't one. Applying in Arkansas was a big advantage. Because of the size of our state and its college population, there were fewer competitors. I probably wouldn't have made it to the regional level if I'd been from New York, California, or some other big state competing against students from Ivy League schools that had well-honed systems to recruit and train their best students for the Rhodes competition. I got through the Arkansas interviews and was off to New Orleans for the finals. In the end, the committee had selected one guy from New Orleans, two from Mississippi, and me. After we talked to the press, I called Mother, who'd been waiting anxiously by the phone, and asked her how she thought I'd look in English tweeds. Lord, I was happy. Happy for Mother after all she'd lived through to get me to that day. Happy that Daddy's last prediction came true. Happy for the honor and the promise of the next 2 years. For a while, the world just stopped. There was no Vietnam, no racial turmoil, no trouble at home, no anxieties about myself or my future. I had a few more hours in New Orleans, and for once I enjoyed the city they call the Big Easy like a native son. 1968 was one of the most tumultuous and heartbreaking years in American history. February brought the Tet Offensive, a military disaster that shifted American popular sentiment against the war in Vietnam. In March, hobbled by the ever-worsening debacle in Southeast Asia, President Johnson announced that he would not seek or accept his party's nomination for a second term in office. Perhaps the worst news of all came later that spring and summer. On the night of April 4th, Martin Luther King was killed on the balcony outside his room at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, where he had gone to support striking sanitation workers. In the last couple of years of his life, King had broadened his civil rights agenda to include an assault on urban poverty and outspoken opposition to the war. His assassination touched off riots in New York, Boston, Chicago, Detroit, and Memphis. It was especially bad in Washington, in the predominantly black business areas along 14th and 8th Streets. President Johnson called out the National Guard to restore order, but the atmosphere remained tense. Georgetown was at a safe distance from the violence, but we had a taste of it when a few hundred guardsmen camped out in McDonough Gym, where our basketball team played its games. Many black families were burned out of their homes and took refuge in local churches. I signed up with the Red Cross to help deliver food, blankets, and other supplies to them. My 1963 white Buick convertible with Arkansas plates and the Red Cross logo plastered on the doors cut a strange sight in the mostly empty streets, marked by still-smoking buildings and storefronts with broken glass from looting. I made the drive once at night, then again on Sunday morning. In the daylight, it felt safe, so I got out and walked around a little, looking at the riot's wreckage. It was perhaps the only time I've ever felt insecure in a black neighborhood. And I thought, not for the first or last time, that it was sad and ironic that the primary victims of black rage were black themselves. In June, just before I graduated from college, Bobby Kennedy, the great hope of the Democratic Party, was shot to death during a campaign event in Los Angeles. My roommate, Tommy Kaplan, woke me in the middle of the night to tell me about it. Once again, I had lost a personal hero, and America had lost a source of its conscience and leadership to the future. Though I was preparing to go to Oxford, August was one of 1968's craziest months, and it was hard to look ahead. It began with the Republican convention in Miami Beach, where New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller's bid to defeat a resurgent Richard Nixon showed just how weak the moderate wing of the party had become, and where Governor Ronald Reagan of California first emerged as a potential president with his appeal to true conservatives. Nixon won on the first ballot with 692 votes, to 277 to Rockefeller and 182 for Reagan. His message was simple. He was for law and order at home and peace with honor in Vietnam. The Democratic Convention in Chicago presented the spectacle of a party riven by civil rights in Vietnam. Television viewers watched as delegates hurled abuse at each other on the convention floor, and the Chicago police rioted against protesters in the streets. This sharply divided convention nominated Vice President Hubert Humphrey, a leading proponent of civil rights, hamstrung by his adherence to the president's pro-war policy. Much of my public life was spent trying to bridge the cultural and psychological divide that widened into a chasm in Chicago. I won a lot of elections, and I think I did a lot of good. But the more I tried to bring people together, the madder it made the fanatics on the right. Unlike the kids in Chicago, they didn't want America to come back together. They had an enemy, and they meant to keep it.